During the course of the Sunday morning class during this bicentennial year, I resolved to address myself to a series of lectures under the general title, Vignettes of American Methodism. And last week we began by talking about the Methodist heritage from England and about the Methodist spirit and some of the distinctives of the Methodist movement as it came into being in the 18th century. Today I want to turn our attention to the coming to America of that tradition which would eventually be a part of the United Methodist heritage. And so I ask you to think back with me today to the date, November 14th, 1784. Barely a year after the peace treaty which ended the American Revolution, the place was a solid preaching house, 42 feet by 48 feet, built of brick near the Philip Barrett homestead in Dover, Delaware. An assembly of the Methodists in the area roundabout had gathered that evening to hear a new preacher newly arrived from England, and we are told there was scarcely room for those in the chapel to breathe, so crowded was the house. The sermon was well along to its high point of climax when a man of considerable authority and obvious assurance slipped into the back of the room. He stood because there were no seats, and he listened as the sermon moved towards its climax. In typical Methodist style, with typical Methodist warmth, the preacher spoke of the love and the grace of God towards men and women, and he closed his sermon to a deep silence. Whereupon the late arrival moved down the center aisle, up onto the platform, and there embraced the preacher with the embrace of the early Christians. And the other preachers and laymen present, so we are told, wept at this sign of Methodist fellowship. So met Thomas Coke, John Wesley's first delegate to America since the end of the Revolutionary War, and Francis Asbury, who was destined to be perhaps the greatest of the first generation leaders of American Methodism. And it was a meeting filled with emotion. For not in 9 years had any representatives of Mr. Wesley been able to pierce the British blockade and make their way to that scattered group of Methodists who had been founded before the Revolution. Oh, there were about 5,000 of them in 1775. Of all the men that Wesley had sent to lead the Americans, only Asbury had remained with the colonists during their struggle for freedom. And when the news came that Wesley himself supported the royal government, there had been deep depression among American Methodists. But despite some shrinkage during the early Revolution, the Methodists had hung together, and despite the disillusion with Wesley's politics, Asbury had kept them loyal to the Wesleyan religious ideal. In a matter of hours after their embrace in the pulpit of Barrett's Chapel, Coke had opened to Asbury Wesley's plan for the reorganization of American Methodism. It was Coke's intent to carry out that plan at once, and that plan involved Coke and the two ministers who had come with him proceeding at once to ordain Mr. Asbury as a priest and ordaining such others as it might seem appropriate to ordain, and then to consecrate Mr. Asbury as co-superintendent of American Methodism with Thomas Coke. To his absolute startlement, Asbury refused to be ordained. At least he refused to be ordained at once. For Mr. Asbury had lived the last 8 years of his life in a land filled with revolution, in a land in love with liberty, amongst a people who conceived they were struggling for their inalienable rights, and he had learned something from the experiment. The refusal startled Coke. If Mr. Wesley could have been notified by Western Union immediately that Asbury had refused, it would have flabbergasted him. For if there was one thing that Mr. Wesley was not used to, it was being told no when he said yes. The refusal may even have frightened Francis Asbury. He was 39 years of age that day at Barrett's Chapel. For 22 of those years, he had circulated and itinerated in support of and preaching at the direction of Mr. Wesley. During the last 8 years, his recurrent command and theme in organizational matters had been, American Methodists, wait till we can communicate with Mr. Wesley. Don't go off on your own direction. To now break that pattern of obedience, even for a short time, required important consideration and was not to be undertaken lightly. Francis Asbury was born on the 20th of August, 1745, in Handsworth Parish, Staffordshire, England. His father was of the working class, and though apparently neither a profane nor a violent man, we gather that his concern for or part in the raising of young Francis was minimal. His religious posture was apparently a rather benevolent neutrality towards the religion of his wife. That is, he accepted the fact that she was Christian and evangelistically so, but he never became professedly a Christian himself. He entertained her ministerial friends at his table on Sunday after Sunday after Sunday as the Wesley itinerants came to Staffordshire. His name was Joseph, and like another Joseph of famous memory, his attributes seem to have gotten lost in a more remarkable wife. For remarkable, Elizabeth Asbury certainly was. She came to her deep religious conviction by the root of suffering. Her first child, Sarah, died young, and the mother found solace from the loss of her child in the moving preaching of the Wesleys and the followers of the Wesleys. In those days, the revival was in the first bloom of its preaching. Her conversion experience determined the rest of her life, and it determined her influence upon her son, who was born shortly after she was converted. Elizabeth Asbury, like Susanna Wesley, was persuaded that her son had a great future in the service of God. She did all she could to prepare him for that service. His own memories, for instance, picture her on her knees beside his bed, singing the hymns of Isaac Watts to him in babyhood. And then he continues, "When the baby's speech was nothing but meaningless mumblings of babyhood, his mother taught him to clasp his hands and look up to heaven and address his childish confidences to God, who alone could understand them. When he was old enough to comprehend, she told him of heaven and hell and God and Jesus Christ and of the fall of man." Under such influence, he grew up, went for a time to school, though his education was neglected, and finally was apprenticed to a button maker. He had thus been trained to see himself as a sinner in the eyes of God and in need of conversion, in need of a heartwarming experience of the assurance of God's love and of God's assistance. He attended preaching regularly in the Church of England. He heard many fine preachers, but none that seemed to speak directly to his condition. Urged on, we presume, by his mother, he went to hear the Methodist preachers. A breakthrough came in his 15th and 16th year. "I was then about 15, and young as I was, the Word of God made deep impression on my heart, which brought me to Jesus Christ, who graciously justified my guilty soul through faith in his precious blood, and showed me the excellency and the necessity of holiness. About 16, I experienced a marvelous display of the grace of God, which some might have thought was full sanctification." He did not think so, incidentally. "And I was indeed very, very happy." More than this, we don't know about the conversion experience, save the most important single fact about the conversion experience. And that was that it drove him out of Staffordshire and into the larger world beyond. For the same mother who had told him he must be converted had also taught him that to experience the grace and the presence of God was most assuredly to share that experience. That witnessing is a part of the obligation of the devout Christian. Almost at once he began to speak at occasional meetings. By the time he was 17, Mr. Wesley had licensed him as an exhorter and then later as a preacher. Licensed as a local preacher in the Methodist Society, he spent 4 years itinerating in his own area. That is, when the major itinerant who was appointed to the area of Staffordshire was appointed, he was appointed to 25 or 30 churches, or societies as they were called then. He knew, however, that there were 6 or 8 local preachers like Mr. Asbury within the area that he was appointed to. And so the first thing he did when he was appointed was to sit down and work out a quarter, that is 13 weeks, a quarter's preaching schedule. And while he would himself make the progression from place to place during major portions of the preaching, on Sunday mornings or Wednesday evenings or Thursday mornings or what have you, when he couldn't be present at a given place, he would place the local preachers to preach in those locations. Sometimes people think that because there was only one preacher and 30 churches, that each church heard preaching only once every 30 Sundays. And of course, that wasn't it at all. Each church heard preaching on a regular schedule. They just heard the itinerant once every 30 times or so because the others were filling in for him. He was successful enough in this local itineration that when he was 21, Mr. Wesley appointed him as itinerant in charge for Staffordshire and Gloucestershire. The next year, he itinerated in Bedfordshire in Sussex. Mr. Wesley didn't believe in letting Methodist preachers settle down and get their roots in too deep. They moved every year. The next year, he was in Northamptonshire, and 1770 took him to Wiltshire. And as Asbury thus became deeper and deeper involved in Methodist organization, it behooves us to pause for a moment and recall for our own information and assurance just what it was, Methodism was, in Asbury and Wesley's time. And the first thing we need to say is that for the first 50 years of its history, Methodism was not a church. It was not intended to be so or planned to be so, and if it had been up to Mr. Wesley, it would never have become a church. Rather, Methodism in those early days was a society. It was a community of folk within the Church of England, baptized members of the Church of England, a community of folk within the Church of England who wished to pursue more extensively than most of the membership did the pursuit of piety, worship, prayer, and individual religious growth. Mr. Wesley sometimes called them the little church within the church, by which he meant they were a society of folk, a group of folk whose primary membership and loyalty was to the Mother Church of England, while their immediate membership was to a small group of folk whom they got to know very well, whom they could counsel with very closely, as each sought to help the other in the growing or nurturing of their faith. Those small groups always started small, a dozen or so, perhaps, who would gather together after Mr. Wesley had preached and organized themselves to meet on a regular schedule. But they began to grow and grow and grow. And in the towns particularly, these Methodist societies sometimes got to the point where they had more people attending society meeting than went on Sunday morning to the church service. Mr. Wesley always insisted, however, that a Methodist was expected to attend the sacrament of the Holy Communion in the Church of England on a regular basis. If a Methodist had children, the children would be baptized in the Church of England. And when Methodists died, they were buried in the Church of England parish graveyard. There was no sense in his mind that they were a dissenting congregation. Those society meetings eventually grew large, hearing the preaching, celebrating together, rejoicing in the word. And Mr. Wesley recognized that they had become too large, that there was insufficient opportunity for the intimacy of nurture and growth, and so he subdivided them into groups of a dozen or so, which he called classes. And he appointed class meetings, class leaders, men and women of spiritual accomplishment, to lead each one of those class meetings. And these men and women then had the task of assisting individuals within the class in their growth in grace and in their growth in the Spirit. So it was, early Methodist meetings were never held on Sunday morning. Methodists were supposed to be in the Church of England on Sunday morning. Sunday evening, after evening prayer, certainly. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday mornings at 5 a.m., before people went to work, a perfectly logical time. I'm not convinced. A perfectly logical time for Methodists to meet. The sacraments were ordinarily not given at Methodist meetings because it was expected they would be enjoyed at the Church of England. The leadership of the Methodists included a half dozen or so ordained Church of England clergy, of whom the Wesley brothers were the most important. But the overwhelming majority of those who came to preach and lead the meetings, who itinerated from place to place, were, like Asbury, lay preachers, quite unordained, with only Wesley's license to preach and their own incandescence as the guarantees that they were legitimate preachers. Now that their own incandescence is a crucial factor. Mr. Wesley once remarked, when somebody attacked his preachers because they were not well educated, he once replied, "In that one thing which they pretend to know, Jesus Christ and Him crucified, they are not ignorant men." The preachers of his generation were experiential Christians, and they testified and shared their experience. Each year, Mr. Wesley summoned those of the itinerants whom he wished to attend an annual conference, a fairly familiar word at Lakeside, in one or another of the cities of England. And it was natural that so promising a youngster as Francis Asbury should have been invited to attend the 1771 annual conference, which met at Bristol. Now in his 26th year, he was approaching the fullness of those talents which would make him the greatest leader of American Methodism for 40 years. At the conference, he could not but hear of the new work in America. For in 1771, the oldest chapel in America was a little over 5 years of age. It had been started without Wesley's approval or advance consultation by a lay preacher from Ireland who had come over from Ireland and settled in America and begun to preach in the area roundabout. From that lay preacher and his friends in 1769, letters had been addressed to the Wesleyan Conference asking for assistance from Mr. Wesley. And in 1769, Mr. Wesley had sent two preachers to come to America, not ordained men, local, or rather lay preachers. Those preachers immediately added their letters to the letters of the American lay leadership that we must have more preachers, we must have more preachers. And at the conference of 1771, Mr. Asbury listened while Wesley read the letters from America urging someone to come over. And Mr. Wesley introduced the letters by saying, "I have a call from Macedonia to come over and help us." The clear identification in Wesley and in Asbury's mind with the experience described in the book of Acts here is quite clear. In any case, Mr. Asbury volunteered, Wesley accepted his offer, and in his journal, as he waited to embark, he set down his thoughts. "Whither am I going? To the new world. What to do? To gain honor? No, not if I know my own heart. To get money? No. I am going to live to God and bring others so to do. In America, there has been a work of God, but it has declined. The people God owns in England are the Methodists. There's nothing unchauvinist about the early Methodists. The people God owns in England are the Methodists. The doctrines they preach and the disciplines they enforce are, I believe, the purest of any people now in the world. If God does not acknowledge me in America, I will soon return to England." That is, he puts himself up against the ultimate test. Will God use his ministry for the conversion and for the gathering of new converts? If he doesn't, he'll come back to England. He was destined, of course, never to return. He's going because he is convinced that his going is pleasing to God, whom he is convinced has chosen the Methodists, and thus needs laborers like Asbury for the harvest that he would have the Methodists to reap in the new world. Asbury came to an America burgeoning in the assurance of youth, in the prosperity of natural abundance, and he came to an America filled with dissatisfaction at English rule and English interference. When he arrived in New York in 1771, the Boston Massacre was just 1 year in the past. The Boston Tea Party lay 2 years in the future. The Battle of Lexington would be fought within 3.5 years. Asbury's superiors in the New World were Wesley's earlier appointees, and he was assigned to travel and preach in a nice little circuit. The boundaries of the circuit on the south were the Delaware-Maryland boundary, on the north, the New York boundary, on the west, the Allegheny Mountains, and on the east, the Atlantic Ocean. And within that nice little area, all of modern Pennsylvania, part of New York State, and all of New Jersey, he itinerated during the succeeding years until the outbreak of the war. But a crisis lay ahead. A crisis for Asbury personally and a crisis for Methodism institutionally. That Methodists survived that crisis in America and then grew from the smallest denomination in America in 1784 to the largest Protestant denomination by the middle of the next century is largely due to the fact that Methodism had Francis Asbury, a man who knew how to adapt to revolutionary circumstances, a man who knew how to sing the songs of the Lord in a new and sometimes very, very strange land. A man, in short, with the vision to serve the present age. Crisis, of course, was the American Revolution. Now, the Revolution would be hard enough on the Methodists in any case because it was hard on all Americans during that period. But it was particularly hard on the Methodists for several particular circumstances. In the first place, Mr. Wesley very strongly disapproved of the revolt. And he made that disapproval abundantly clear. His calm address to the American colonies, quote unquote, was written to dissuade the Americans from revolution. And he may have thought it was calm, but the Americans didn't think so. It sounded to them like he was taking the royal side right down the line. They were right. He was. He ridiculed their no taxation without representation doctrine. You know, when I grew up as a high school student and I first, or grade school student, I suppose, and I first heard that ringing cry, no taxation without representation, it made perfect sense to me, and I couldn't understand why it didn't make sense to the English. It must be because English are naturally tyrannous, and that's the reason we had the revolution or something of the sort, you know. But it didn't make any sense to Mr. Wesley either. For Mr. Wesley said in his book, what is it that makes you Americans think that the right to participate in your own taxation is a right of Englishmen? You say you are fighting for the rights of Englishmen, and yet you are demanding rights that almost no Englishmen exercise. He said, I'm an English citizen. I have been all my life. I've paid taxes ever since I grew old enough to pay taxes. I have never voted for a member of the House of Parliament for a very simple reason. I don't have any right to vote for members of the House of Parliament. It is not a right of Englishmen to vote for the House of Commons. Those who vote for the right of for the membership in the House of Commons are those to whom the king has given the privilege of choosing the national leaders. And who are they? They are those who have an income from land of at least £200 a year. And says Mr. Wesley, I've never had an income of £200 a year. So of course I haven't voted. What's more, neither have 99.997% of the other Englishmen ever voted. For it is only a very, very tiny proportion of the landholders in England who vote. So he said, what are you babbling about? You say you want the rights of Englishmen, you've got it. You've got the right to pay the taxes that Parliament passes, just like every other Englishman has. Again, Methodism had been strongly tied to the Church of England. Remember, we said a few moments ago that if you were a Methodist, you went to the Church of England to receive the sacraments of the Lord's Supper and baptism. As long as there is an abundant number of Anglican priests available, that's no problem for the Methodists. And in England, they could usually find a Church of England minister who would provide the sacraments when needed. But now in America, as the Revolution progresses, Church of England pastors prove to be distressingly loyal to the king and to the Tories. They seem to identify with great regularity with the conservative cause, and many of them left America altogether. Some went to Canada, some went back to England, some went off to far off Louisiana. Indeed, by 1779, two-thirds of the Anglican priests of the Church of England in Virginia had left Virginia. And well over two-thirds of the Anglican churches in Virginia were thus without ministers capable of providing the sacraments. And so the Methodists find themselves cut off from sacramental sources because the Church of England ministers are proving to be Tories and leaving the colonies in droves. Moreover, all of Mr. Wesley's leaders, there were about 12 of them by 1775, all of the leaders that Mr. Wesley sent to the New World to lead American Methodism, with one exception, proved to be Tories as well. The majority of them packed up and went back to England, and the couple who didn't go back to England retired from active ministry for reasons of health. Thus, American Methodism, in more senses than one, as you suggest, thus American Methodism was thrown into confusion. It had lost access to the sacraments. Many of its best trained leaders were disappearing. It was identified with an Englishman over there in England who kept making the most outrageous statements that got them into trouble here in America. The 12th of Wesley's missionaries, of course, was Asbury himself. But even Asbury's safety could not be assured during the Revolutionary War. He stayed in America, and he'd identified with the care of the Methodists, and he tried to stay out of politics. But he was known to be an Englishman devoted to John Wesley. An Englishman devoted to John Wesley can't stay out of politics in this period. For a time, he traveled openly, but as reports of Methodist preachers mobbed, jailed, tarred and feathered, and on several occasions nearly hung, I've known some congregations in modern days who were so inclined, but they didn't actually get that far. As these reports kept coming in, Asbury's influence and travels were curtailed. For nearly 2 years, indeed, he had to stop traveling and go into hiding, because if he itinerated and arrived at a new town and went to the local Methodist local preacher's home to stay, a mob might very well gather outside the Methodist local preacher's home and burn it down. For the safety of his hosts, he had to stop traveling. As for the Methodists, several possible courses laid open before them. One was simply to disintegrate under the pressures of war. The Methodists might have scattered and become members of other churches. For feelings ran very high, both within and without the societies, and it would have been very easy to stop being a Methodist in the 1770s. Indeed, it's clear that's exactly what happened with some of the Methodists. For the first time in Methodist history, in 1778, there was a shrinkage in total membership. Every other year, the annual conference reports growth, 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 and then in 1778 and 9, there is shrinkage. And apparently, this is the product of the pressures of the war and of the loss of many of their itinerating preachers. Asbury tried to counter this by his own travels, when it was possible for him to travel, and by his letters, where he could not go in person. Moreover, he encouraged the Native American preachers who could travel more freely than he could to continue their itineration and encourage the faithful in their faith and to remind the members of the unique character of Methodism. Another possibility would have been for Methodism to simply declare its independence of Mr. Wesley. That is, if a part of the embarrassment is that Mr. Wesley keeps making statements that you wish he would keep to himself, then maybe the time has come for not only a declaration of independence from George III, but also from John Wesley. The great pressure in this direction was the critical problem of the sacraments. Wesley had insisted that the Methodists take the sacraments in the Anglican Church. Wesley had made no provision for the ordination of Methodist preachers capable of providing the sacraments. And Wesley had insisted that the sacraments are enormously important to the spiritual growth of the individual Christian. Now, many of you who are modern-day Methodists may find that comes as a bit of a surprise. For it is remarkable how easily modern Methodist churches get along without regular Sunday communion. It would have come to us as a surprise to Mr. Wesley that Methodists got along without regular Sunday communion as easily as they do. Mr. Wesley believed that the sacraments are indeed, as Augustine put it, the channels of grace whereby the grace of God reaches humankind. the channels of grace whereby the grace of God reaches humankind. And he believed that the sacrament of the Holy Supper was important to him. There are long periods in which he communes every day of the week. He believed they were important to the Methodists, and he believed it was important to the survival of the Methodist societies. Now, if Mr. Wesley has convinced the American Methodists that the sacraments are important, but then has left them in a situation in which they can't get the sacraments because the Church of England ministers are no longer available to provide them, it is natural that some will argue, well, if it's all that important, let's ordain each other the way the Baptists and the Presbyterians do. Let us provide the sacraments for their members as they are needed, and if Mr. Wesley doesn't like it, he can lump it. That's not exactly their words, but that was the burden of their instruction. For 1 year, indeed, in 1779-80, that's precisely what a group of the Methodists in Virginia did. In Asbury's absence, they ordained each other, and during the succeeding year, they delivered the sacrament to the Methodists. But the next year, Asbury was at their conference. By 1780, Mr. Asbury had succeeded in convincing the military authorities, at least, that he was not pro-king, and it was possible for him to begin to travel again. He came to Flavanna, where the conference met, and urged the folk who were there not to break with the Wesleyan practice in the middle of the war. Wait, he said, at least until Mr. Wesley can be consulted after the war is over. To move hastily, he says, will split the American Methodists from their founder. Worse, it will split the American Methodists from each other, for the decision to ordain was by no means universally approved. The argument went hot and heavy on the floor of the conference. At one such meeting, Mr. Asbury left the conference for the night convinced that he had lost, that he had made the argument the best he knew how, and he had failed. He came back the next morning, he tells us, having spent a night on his knees in the most urgent prayer of his life. The next morning, when he returned to the meeting, he found a change in mood, and a decision was taken to await the end of the war and to ordain no more. Now, schism in American Methodism was avoided largely due to his persuasiveness, but it was a very near thing. And Asbury wrote to Wesley a letter that was smuggled out to get it across the Atlantic via Portugal. Asbury wrote to Wesley stating the problems and pressing the need for properly ordained leaders for Methodism in America, despite Wesley's resistance to such ordinations. His argument: it will require a revolutionary action to serve the present age in America. It was in large part in answer to Asbury's reports that Mr. Wesley finally did decide to ordain. Now, this is an enormously presumptuous act from the Anglican point of view. Wesley is not an Anglican bishop. Only Anglican bishops have the power to ordain Anglican priests in Anglican theory. When Wesley resolved to ordain, it was a revolutionary act in response to a revolutionary situation. He summoned Mr. Coke. Mr. Coke was already ordained, an Anglican priest, but not an Anglican bishop. He then consecrated Coke as superintendent for America, and with the help of Coke and a third Anglican priest, the three of them then ordained two additional lay preachers as priests to provide the sacraments in America. Then the three men, Coke and the two new ordinands, were sent to America. They were instructed to find Mr. Asbury, to ordain him a priest, and consecrate him as co-superintendent with Mr. Coke. They were then to gather and ordain such other American ministers as might seem necessary or appropriate to the future of the societies. Mr. Wesley justified this procedure by arguing that it was coherent with the practice of the ancient Church of Alexandria, where ordination was normally by three deacons rather than by the bishop operating alone. You will pick up a a remnant, if you will, of this argument and of this theory if you attend a ordination service for Methodist elders. For if you have attended those ordination services in the course of the last 2 or 3 weeks of the West Ohio or East Ohio Conference, you will have noted that when the elders are ordained, they are always ordained by 3 people. The bishop is one of them, but there are always 2 other ordained ministers who participate in that ordination. This goes right back to Mr. Wesley's argument that the ancient practice at Alexandria was ordination by 3 elders. I say Mr. Wesley justified his procedure as coherent with the practice of the Church of Alexandria, but there were many who disagreed. And Charles, his brother, expressed his opposition quite characteristically in verse. How easy now are bishops made at man or woman's whim. Wesley his hands on Coke hath laid, but who laid hands on him? Asbury, too, realized that something important was being decided. He refused Coke's consecration and ordination until such time as American leaders could meet and confirm Mr. Wesley's plan. Asbury had no problem whatever with the notion that Asbury could ordain, that Wesley could ordain if he wished. His problem with the ordination was he was being ordained without consultation with the American Methodist leadership. And he says, in effect, that's simply not going to work in America. Certainly not in America that has just won a revolutionary war. After some hesitation, Coke agreed that the Methodist ministers should be summoned, and Freeberg Garrison was sent out, like an arrow, we are told, to gather the Methodist preachers to a special conference. It was a rather dilatory arrow, since only about 2/3 of the preachers actually got there. A month later, at Lovely Lane Chapel in Baltimore, Maryland, 3/4 of the American Methodist preachers gathered to hear the invocation of God upon their meeting. Hearing Mr. Wesley's wishes, they then proceeded of their own will to elect Mr. Asbury and Mr. Coke as their superintendents, whereupon Mr. Asbury submitted to be ordained and consecrated. When Mr. Wesley heard about it, he considered it to be presumptuous in the extreme. He had appointed them as superintendent. What need did they have of conferences? But that's exactly the point. Every American Methodist bishop since has been elected in America by the American church. The conference also adopted the 24 Articles of Religion. Wesley had adapted these from the Book of Common Prayer, and the American Conference added a 25th article of religion having to do with the American government. They also adopted Wesley's Sunday service and the Wesley Book of Hymns. The former, the Sunday service, they promptly forgot, and most of you have never used the full Wesley service. The Book of Hymns, they sang and sang and sang and sang. But they doubtless went further than Mr. Wesley had intended. Wesley thought he was, quote, appointing superintendents over our brethren in America who desire to remain under my, that is Wesley's, who desire to remain under my care and who desire to adhere to the doctrine and discipline of the Church of England. What emerged in America in 1784 was a Methodist Episcopal Church, with its own discipline quite separate from the discipline of the Church of England, and it was soon calling its superintendents bishops. Now, it is that transition that took place at the Christmas conference that's the reason we're celebrating the bicentennial of American Methodism. 1984 is not the bicentennial of the first Methodist preaching in America. That goes back at least as far as 1763. It is not the bicentennial of Mr. Asbury's coming to America. That's 1771. We celebrate 1984 as the bicentennial because in that year, at the annual conference, Methodism ceased to be a society of the Church of England and became an independent church capable of providing its own sacraments in America. And so when we talk about the American Methodist churches, we are talking about the descendants of the action at the Christmas Conference of 1784. Now, having called themselves the Methodist Episcopal Church, it was not illogical to call their superintendents bishops. And I'm not going to get into the problem of translation from the Greek that's involved as to what the real meaning in English or real translation in English of the word episkopos is supposed to be. One can argue that it can be superintendent. One can argue that it can be monetary supervisor or comptroller. One can argue that it should be bishop, as historically it usually has been. The American Methodists adopted the title bishop as a way of referring to their superintendents, what Wesley had called superintendents. As I say, there's a logic in this in the translation of the Greek word episkopos. The illogic of it, as Mr. Wesley saw it, was that it was the title that was used by the Anglicans for the heads of their church. And he said, if the Methodists call their heads bishops, there is going to be endless trouble with the Anglicans. He was right. We've had 200 years of it. And so he wrote, "How can you? How dare you suffer yourself to be called bishop? I shudder, I start at the very thought. Men may call me a knave or a fool, a rascal, a scoundrel, and I am content, but never by my consent shall they call me bishop. For my sake, for Christ's sake, put a full end to this." One can imagine how Mr. Wesley must have started and shuddered when he read in the 1789 minutes, "Who are the persons that exercise the episcopal office in the Methodist Church?" and found his name headed the list. In fact, something had happened in America that Mr. Wesley had not anticipated at all. He had intended to provide for his followers, and his followers were a subgroup within Anglicanism. The conference under Asbury's leadership had turned the Methodist societies into a church with bishops and a separate discipline, which the far distant Mr. Wesley could hardly recognize, much less supervise. Asbury had realized that the liberty-mad Methodists of America would not tolerate autocracy from America. He had demanded a conference where they could vote. He also apparently recognized that the beloved old gentleman in England had to be edged out of the active leadership of the far distant American churches. With the best of good intentions, Mr. Wesley was too far removed geographically, emotionally, and experientially from the American experience to continue to lead that experience on a day-to-day basis. Asbury did not hesitate to create the kind of institutions he thought he needed to meet the needs of America, of the American situation, his goal to serve the present age. And Mr. Wesley's feelings were hurt. His letters make this clear. But hurt or not, it was essential for American Methodism to become free of the English dead hand of tradition. She needed a leader who was in the United States, who understood the American experiment. She needed an administrator of genius, a preacher of spirit, and a lovely, kindly counselor. In short, American Methodism in 1784 needed someone to be for American Methodism what John Wesley had been for English Methodism 50 years earlier. And she needed a man who would write with the deepest respect and love and affection to and about Mr. Wesley, and regularly disobey Mr. Wesley when he thought Wesley's recommendations were not appropriate to serve the present age. For with the revolutionary atmosphere of the war past, American life now entered a new revolutionary situation. What had been 13 colonies sandwiched in between the Atlantic on the east and the Appalachians on the west now became a free nation whose western boundary was the Mississippi River. In the next decade, millions were flooded through the Berkshire Gap and the Delaware Water Gap and the Valley of the Susquehanna and the Cumberland Gap and the Valley of Virginia to find their way to the new frontier. The result would create convulsive problems in the old colonies and a revolutionary situation on the frontier, and Asbury was determined that Methodists should serve that situation, the present age. He was a firm leader of the next two generations. In one sense, the sense that Wesley had been dictator of English Methodism, perhaps it is appropriate to say that Asbury became the dictator of American Methodism. But his stewardship is very hard to fault. During 38 years of his leadership, Methodist membership multiplied 41.5 times, from 5,000 to 208,000 members. The most striking thing about his episcopacy is clearly his travels. He ranged from English Canada to Spanish Florida, from the Atlantic to the Mississippi. In the course of his travels, he apparently visited New York over 50 times, New Jersey over 60, Pennsylvania 78, Maryland 80, North Carolina 63, South Carolina 46, Virginia 84, Tennessee and Georgia over 20 each, Massachusetts 23 times, and all of it without the Allegheny commuter or Amtrak. He was persuaded that one weakness of Methodism was the temptation of its ministers to settle comfortably in cities to pastor an established congregation as the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians did. Those who really need the message, he said, are in the relatively unchurched areas, the distant valleys of the Great Smokies, the isolated islands of the Great Lakes, the shores of Winnipesaukee, the mountains of southern Maine, the upper reaches of the Suwannee, of the Allegheny, of the Susquehanna, of the Monongahela, of the Mississippi. To meet this need, he adapted and adopted revolutionary methods to serve his present age. Under his direction, Methodism became frontier-oriented and Methodist ministers became itinerant wanderers. Asbury also sought to serve the older and more established areas, but it was the frontier that most fascinated him. It's no accident in the 1980s that Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and Michigan and Pennsylvania are the heartland of Methodism. There are more Methodists in the two conferences in the state of Ohio than in the whole Western jurisdiction, from Denver west. This is so because Francis Asbury recognized the challenge of the frontier and picked up that challenge. He set the pattern for what it meant to serve the present age. He knew long before modern business discovered it that men and women work best if they know the boss is looking. And his travels are designed to make them know the boss is looking. As the years passed, other innovations followed. The district superintendency, the delegated quadrennial general conference. When the camp meeting idea was first broached, it was broached by the Presbyterians. Mr. Asbury embraced it. Within a decade, there were dozens of camp meetings and more Methodists than all of the other denominations combined. For Asbury sensed that in the meeting of the masses of the seeking on the frontier, social and emotional needs were being met as well as religious needs. Albert Outler, perhaps the outstanding historian of Methodism in America, wrote in a recent article, "American Methodism is more Asbarian than it is Wesleyan. That is, it is more Asbarian in its organization, because Asbury took the Wesleyan organizational forms and adapted them to serve the present age in America. And the adaptations are, in many cases, quite different than the originals." But scarce would a revival meeting be over before Asbury himself would be pushing on again. Stamford, Providence, Boston, Lynn, Worcester, Albany, Syracuse, Buffalo, Erie, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Springfield, Cairo, Louisville, Lexington, Harlan, Asheville, Savannah, Raleigh, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York City, and then around again. Always traveling, always preaching, always ready to try something new if he thought it would do the work of the Lord more effectively. He died in 1816, as I suspect he would have wanted it, on the way to annual conference. To serve the present age. Our calling to fulfill. Oh, may it all our powers engage to do the Master's will.